My name is Mary Coffin, and I'm one of the coordinators of the media management website called MediaVice. MediaVice is an Irish-based, not-for-profit project which sets out to critique mainstream news coverage for what we perceive as a drift towards an increasingly pro-corporate agenda in Irish news reporting, a tendency which we think often leads to reading, listening, or viewing public with a biased understanding of events. We owe our inspiration in large part to the encouragement and support of David Edwards and David Cromwell, editors of the similar UK website MediaLens, and who were the authors of the book Guardians of Power, an acclaimed analysis of British news media. In an article published by MediaVice last autumn, we criticised RTE online news reporting for seeming to accept unquestioningly the claims of anonymous US military sources about a violent event in Iraq, and when we challenged them about this, for claiming that the eyewitness accounts of Iraqi people were unreliable. Eyewitness accounts are ordinarily a valued source for any journalist. So what is it, we ask, that has brought us to a situation where a journalist can so clearly abandon the principles of balance and fairness which are supposed to apply to their work? Is it a matter of established media orthodoxy that the US is an impartial party to what is happening in Iraq? And is that apparent orthodoxy now given by the US allegations about Iran? It was suggested that we organise a debate to discuss these questions, and so here we are. In a speech he gave in 1998, 5 years before the invasion of Iraq, Dick Cheney, current Vice President of the United States and President of the US Senate, said, "Oil is unique in that it is so strategic in nature. We're not talking about soapstick or leisureware here. Energy is truly fundamental to the world's economy. The Gulf War was a reflection of that reality." The US government has since repeatedly denied that the invasion of Iraq 12 years after the First Gulf War had anything to do with oil for strategic advantage. And yet there is Mr. Cheney on record claiming that war in Iraq was about exactly those things. Aside from much vilified columns, internet bloggers, and the alternative news media, we maintain that the majority of mainstream editorials, reports, and front-page headlines and broadcast news seldom reflect influencing factors and evidence like the statement quoted from Dick Cheney. Facts, figures, witnesses, official documents, and even all kinds of evidence was available to the media that cast myriad doubt at least on the official rationale for war, long before the invasion of Iraq commenced and had the media chosen to acknowledge it. We also believe that the media routinely understates or ignores the true scale of opposition to the war. With all of the estimated 1 million dead of the current Iraq conflict, civilians and combatants alike, the injured, maimed and 4 million displaced people of that country at the front of our minds, the merits of the points I've just outlined are the essence of the case to be discussed among panelists this evening. We'd like to express our thanks in advance to Harry Brown and the Dublin Institute of Technology, Joseph and the RTE, and to Geraldine Cahill and the Real News Network in New York, from where this programme is also being webcast. And a special thanks to the panellists participating in the discussion, particularly to those who have travelled from other countries to be here. I'm going to hand over now to Pepe Escobar of the Asia Times and the Real News Network, who's kindly come from Canada to facilitate the discussion here this evening.
Thanks, Leah. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Thanks for our eager followers. Before I introduce our distinguished guests, everybody knows that today is the 5th anniversary of the end of the Iraqi war. Everybody knows that today is the 5th anniversary of the beginning of the Iraq war, the real war. As you probably know, General David Petraeus, the counterinsurgency messiah of the United States Army, was in front of the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee yesterday defending his search. What we can understand from what Petraeus said yesterday is that there's no end in sight, basically. He was literally over the wall. It's a 100-year war if we follow Senator John McCain, Republican presidential candidate. And this is part of what the Pentagon calls itself the Long War, which is the rebranded term of the War on Terror. So this is also part of a very seamless narrative. The war in Iraq mixing with the probable attack on Iraq. So we won't be discussing this here tonight, but we'll always be discussing how the media is dealing with it, with this so-called seamless narrative. Let me now introduce you to our distinguished guests. Fergal Kane, journalist for more than 20 years, reports for RT from Ireland, many other parts of the world, been to Iraq many times, both before and since the invasion. 2004, voted PBI Broadcaster of the Year for his coverage of the war in Iraq. They were last in Iraq beginning of the surge in March 2007, right? And has been reported in the U.S. presidential elections. Patrick Smith, foreign editor of the Irish Times, previously opinion editor, foreign correspondent in Brussels, 2.5 years in Washington as well, 2000-2002. Report on the Bush election, 9/11 aftermath in Afghanistan and Iraq. Founder in the early 90s of the Let In the Light campaign, against censorship and in favor of freedom of information. Joe Ziegler, there he is, from Chicago. News editor of RTE Publishing, includes RTE-IE, RTL, RTE Mobile. Moved to Ireland in October 2006. In the U.S., worked for a number of television stations, public radio programs, producers, including Marketplace, highest-rated business program in the U.S. Founding executive producer for the progressive talk radio network Air America, very influential in the U.S. Dar Jamayil, independent journalist, covered the Middle East for more than 4 years, maybe five. Reported unembedded from inside Iraq. He was in Fallujah in the first siege of Fallujah, not the second one in November. We're going to discuss about that. Reported from Syria, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan. Reports have been published in The Nation, The Guardian, Independent, also in our Asia Times as well. Recently published Beyond the Green Zone, dispatches from an unembedded journalist in occupied Iraq. First book. Already won both the James Aronson Social Journalism Award and the Joe A. Calloway Award for Civic Courage. Kieran O'Reilly took part in 1997 civil rights, free speech, anti-Iranian, Aboriginal, and prisoner solidarity movement in Kingston, Australia. 2003, member of the Pit Stop 12 shares, disabled the U.S. Navy war plane en route to the war in Iraq at Shannon Airport. Its top of shares put in trial three times before being unanimously acquitted of all charges in July 2006. Kino lives with refugees from war zones and works in street homes. Harry Brown, lecturer in the School of Media, WCG of Technology, activist, journalist, served in the steering committee of the Irish Anti-War Movement 2003-2004, member of Anti-War Ireland. Account of the Channel 5 anti-war activists is going to appear this year, right?
That's it.
Right, so we have four main themes of discussion tonight. We're going to open with motivation and rationale for Iraqi war. So we're going to have to touch the evil Saddam issue and his terrifying and invisible WMDs. So let's see what the Irish media was doing at the time, the same as what the American media more or less was doing at the time. So I got a quote here from Tom Cooney, law professor at the University College in Dublin, September 13, 2002. The Iraqi regime poses a real and substantial threat to international peace and security. The UN is equivalent. Only George Bush and Tony Blair have the matter to stand up to. They must be prepared to mount a preemptive strike against Saddam's regime. A preemptive strike would be lawful. His program for developing weapons of mass destruction should frighten the civilized world. He has lethal chemical weapons, including persistent VX gas, which can be as destructive as a nuclear warhead. Well, this more or less reads like a press release straight from the White House or the Pentagon. So this is what the American press was writing at the time, American newspaper. So my first question is, I pose it collectively. to the table. In your opinion, this the Bush Blair j'accuse, in fact, this barrage of accusations, all over 2002 and early 2003, was it countered enough with hard facts available at the time? And I mean that in many aspects, legally, ethically, the potential human cost of war, the number and qualification of the WMD experts who were working in Iraq at the time, the fact that Hans Blix's inspectors were not finding absolutely anything, although they spent months in Iraq, and the fact that anyone who was following the Iraqi government at the time knew that Hussein Kamel was married to one of Saddam's daughters and defected to Amman, Jordan in 1995. He was interviewed by two high-level UN officers, and then he admitted on the record several times that Iraq's nuclear program had been discontinued in the early 90s. So this was more or less public record for people who were following Iraq. So who wants to volunteer for this first question?
I will. It just happened that just before the war, 5 years ago, in the January and February, I was in Iraq under the old regime. It was the weirdest place you could ever be. When you arrived there, you had to bribe your way through the airport to corrupt officials. You were monitored everywhere you went by the intelligence agencies. You believed that every single word you spoke to anybody was being recorded. We were in a hotel. We believed what we were doing in the hotel room, we watched through the TV screen. If you went out, I was at a diplomat's party. Somebody from the Irish Times was invited, actually, and I just jumped in. And they believed everything there around the garden, around Sweden, was being recorded. And it was impossible to find out exactly what the Saddam regime was like. I was in the day Hans Blix delivered his final report. I happened to be in the Ministry of Information in Baghdad watching it. Not one person believed it there that there was not going to be a war. Not one journalist there believed that anything they found or didn't find was going to stop a war. We all thought, and I still believe, that the issue of chemical weapons was a red herring. And I think anybody who read the newspapers properly and looked into things properly at the time would have seen that. It didn't matter whether they or not they had chemical weapons, that the geopolitical strategy that was being adopted by George Bush was they were going into Iraq no matter what. And if some of us were against the war at the time, it was because in Baghdad at the time, everybody was reading that book by Anthony Beaver, Stalin Died, which had just been published, and the Iraqi officials were going around and saying, this Baghdad is going to be the new Stalingrad. There were American journalists. I remember particularly one former Marine saying that the US Army would be broken at the gates of Baghdad. And we believe that the military would be able to put up, the Iraqi military would be able to put up a fight. So I personally was against war because of that. Did I think Saddam should have been spared? Absolutely not. But neither do I think that chemical weapons was ever an issue in that war.
And yet, RTE, various times, day after day, led on the red herring story.
Okay, because they reported from the UN where Colin Powell barefacedly sat up and told lies, and it was reported. But how do you report from a country under a dictatorship like Saddam when you can't find out anything? All you can report on what you see in front of your face.
Well, all that was really being reported on, and I've looked very closely at the media in the period of the run-up to the war, what was really being reported on was the elite argument about, not about whether there were weapons of mass destruction, but about what and when should be done about it. So if the French and the Americans were having a row in the Security Council, that was the story. The UN was consistently the story. Iraq, you know, for all that there were correspondents there, Iraq itself was very rarely the story. The focus of the story was in the elite argument, the argument between elite nations. And in fact, the story that Pepe referred to about the defector, the son-in-law who had the whole line about who had the program, Newsweek published that story in February of 2003 while you were in Iraq. The Irish Times did not cover that story at all. It continued to run the same arguments about what and when should be done about Saddam's WMD, and that is the record of the way that it was covered. That red herring, and we all agree it was a red herring now, but that red herring was the guts of of our news coverage for that period.
But I think that's an overstatement. I mean, I think that the reality is it's very difficult to cover the absence of something, and the absence of evidence that there was no weapons of mass destruction. We reported on a regular basis that the statements coming out from the inspectors to say we can't find anything. But we were not in a position to say there are no weapons of mass destruction. And nobody was in a position to say that. So it was the case that we reported those claims. And we also reported the debate that went on quite rightly in the Security Council and among the nations that were preparing an alliance to go to war. And to not report that would have been a bizarre in the extreme. And I think that you're overstating your case very, very strangely.
I think the only period Saddam was a threat to his neighbours was the 1980s, when the British and American governments and British and American weapons companies were aiding him in the invasion of Iran. Also, at the end of Gulf War I, when the United States let him clean up the opposition in the South. The only weapon of mass destruction in the 1990s was the US-led sanctions that Madeleine Albright acknowledged had killed 500,000 children by 1996. So Saddam was a threat to his own people in the 1990s, but not to his neighbours.
I was very struck. I was reporting from Washington in the period after 9/11, and I went back to see what it was that I reported. And 4 days after 9/11, I reported that there was a dispute in the American in the U.S. cabinet that believe it or not, Rumsfeld and Cheney at the time were opposed to extending the war to Iraq, but that Wolfowitz was making the case for war with Iraq, and that the 9/11 should be used as an excuse to do that. Now, from then on, we reported consistently that the divisions within the American administration, the growing case that Rumsfeld then turned around and said, we've got the unfinished business of the previous war. And I was struck when I came back to Ireland in 2002 and attended a number of anti-war meetings out of interest and sympathy, to find that that there were two demons being discussed. One was George Bush, and two was the media, and somehow that we were being blamed for the perceived misconceptions which the public had about the war. The reality was the Irish public did not have any misconceptions, and when we saw the anti-war marches, we saw that the public knew exactly what was going on because they'd been reading about it. And ironically, at those very meetings, I found people denouncing the media, quoting from articles that I had written about the project for a new American century, about the involvement of Cheney in his business affairs, and those sorts of issues we were presenting. We were not campaigning against the war, and I think there's a danger in seeing, for example, in quoting from opinion columnists like Tom Cooney as an example of the bias of the media, because Cooney is a lobbyist for the Israeli government and represents a very specific point of view, and there were counter-arguments being made at the same time in the Irish Times, on the opinion pages of the Irish Times. So I think it's not quite as simple as that.
How did you cover the project for the new American century, let's say, end of 2002, beginning of 2002? Because it's all there. It's all spelled out.
Absolutely.
The whole spread.
And I wrote about it from Washington, saying that there is this group, these are the members, they're penetrating the upper echelons of the American administration. Richard Perle is there.
Did the Irish Times show how they built the case for war, which the American mainstream press never did?
Well, I couldn't swear exactly what I wrote. I mean, I would have to go back and look at it. But it was certainly clear in my mind that I was writing about people who were making a case for war, and that this was something that the Irish readers needed to know about, and I then found myself being quoted by people denouncing media coverage on this very issue.
Yeah, it's important to make the distinction between opinion and news here. My critique is not about, it's not to suggest that the Irish Times didn't give voice to anti-war opinion at times, because it certainly did. It's that the news agenda was allowed to be dominated by what we now describe as the red herring. What Fertel says they already knew was a red herring in February of 2003, that the background of the drive to war was subsumed underneath this argument about something that it turns out didn't exist at all. And I think that we know that, for instance, the New York Times has sort of beat its breast and done mea culpa about the particular way that it's
very different.
No, it's quite different.
It's different, but
Judith Miller.
Yes.
Were you reprinting Judith Miller's article? Nobody was reprinting.
No, I mean, I think I quoted from Judith Miller at some point, but I also quoted stuff saying that she'd been discredited. Questions about Chalabi, who was her main source, I certainly wrote about from Washington at the time.
But the answer doesn't into.
The important thing about Judith Miller, though, was that the people who were going to decide whether the war was going to happen, which was the members of Congress, they were reading the New York Times. They weren't necessarily reading Irish Times. And so the only concrete way you could say the media influenced the drive to war was in the pages of influential newspapers and the information that especially Democratic members of Congress and the Senate, including Hillary Clinton, took from that and said, this is enough for me. I'm going to vote for the war. And but other than that, I think it's hard to make an argument that the media really had any influence over stopping the war. Like, it would have been able to stop the war. I don't think, save those, you know, the Washington Post, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, it would have had the power to do that.
I mean, I read is that the Carl Bernstein series of books on Bush administration, in the first one of those, he just recounted pages and pages of interviews. And then the first one was, I found it quite shocking that all of that Bush administration admitted that from the day they got into power, they were going to have a war in Iraq. They were just looking for an excuse. And, you know, I would agree to a certain extent with Harry that the media gets led by the debate from the top down, even in the Northern Ireland peace process. People were talking about the minutiae of negotiations, but probably the real changes were happening down at street level. That is the way we tend to report news. It's probably our fault, but it encapsulates things in a small area in little bites, maybe that people can understand. But I really don't think anything the media would have done at that time would have stopped the war.
Well, I know in the U.S. a problem is always context with reporting, and you know, forgive me, I don't live here and I'm not familiar with RTE. But I'm a strong critic of a lot of the mainstream media in the United States. And, you know, one thing that anyone could do, which as a journalist, which anyone as a citizen can do as well, is get online, look up things like the U.S. Quadrennial Defense Review Report. So, you know, of course you need to quote the Colin Powells and the Condoleezza Rices and all these people in positions of power. And that's, I don't argue that. We need to hear what those people are saying. But if we're going to quote them, we need to give context, like, okay, well, they said this. And then how did that stack up to, like, things like in the Quadrennial Defense Review Report, which as of a couple of years ago stated that there's an ability, the goal for the U.S. is to have a military that maintains the ability to fight multiple overlapping wars and to, quote, ensure that all major and emerging powers are integrated as constructive actors and stakeholders into the international system. I mean, there's not a lot of democracy in that. So if we're going to quote the people like the Condoleezza Rices and the Dick Cheneys, well, let's quote them, but let's absolutely give the context. Well, okay, and then here's the Quadrennial Defense Review Report. Here's the National Security Strategy of the United States that's based very heavily now, as of 2000, on the project for the American Century. And at least in the U.S. press, I don't know about here, but at least in the U.S. press, I mean, that type of context is rare.
So, at point of view of RTE and Irish Times, do you provide this when you talk about the Pentagon in general and the Pentagon long view, the Pentagon's long war? In your informative piece, I'm not talking about this informative piece.
The Quadrennial Defense Review, I remember writing a lengthy piece about a shift from saying we've got to be able to fight two major wars to one which says we've got to be able to fight one major war and multiple smaller wars. And I explored that issue for the readers of the Irish Times. I think you see, maybe you've got the wrong targets here, and I understand MediaBytes has taken the view that it's got to take shots at what it calls the mainstream media, but it doesn't. This context is much more likely to find itself explained in a paper like the Irish Times, done in a tabloid newspaper, or the mass circulation, other mass circulation papers. And I think that that's where you see no context, and you see war as theatre. You see, you know, particularly we suffer in this country from what I would call a media overhang from the British media, and there they're talking about our boys and our boys facing fire from terrorists, and the journalists are getting swept along in this sort of gung-ho thing, which is really got nothing to do with politics in a way. It's got to do with a notion of adventure and bravery. I mean, it's a completely distorted view of what war is like.
In the run-up to the war, three British national papers actually were kind of poster sites for the anti-war movement. They're much more than the Irish Times. They actually campaigned vigorously and actively, The Guardian, and particularly The Independent and The Mirror.
I think the context the mainstream media didn't provide was Irish involvement in the war, the traction, where the rubber hit the road in Ireland, and it's still hitting the road, and that is Shannon Airport. Was never a major significant story. And given that most American dead in Iraq went through a departure lounge at Shannon, a little bigger than this room, that's very significant. Given that the most disruptive action to US mobilization for war occurred at Shannon, with Merrick Kelly's disarmament action, our action, and four companies leaving the country over security issues following those two actions, these are two very significant phenomena that were marginalized by mainstream media in this country. And that's possibly why the Irish anti-war movement didn't last beyond 15th February, because the story was over once the war began, although Irish involvement in this war continues. Why wasn't there stories about how many Irish mercenaries from the north and the south are fighting in Iraq? One of the first people killed in the Iraq invasion force was a guy from Ballyfermot. Why weren't these stories pursued and followed up? And I think partly because previously with wars you needed to mobilise the whole society, and the role of media was to hype that up. But now we have wars with subcontracted out to private mercenaries, and to the Iraqis through the killing and dying, and to use high technology. So what you want from your public is deflation, marginalisation of significant stories, and silence and sedation, basically. And that's what we've got 5 years into this war.
Can I just say, I think you're doing that math Charlie Fermat a disservice. He wasn't a mercenary, he was a member of the British Army of the Irish Guards, who was killed.
I'm talking about Blackwater as mercenary, but saying one of the first people to die in this war was from Charlie Fermat, but in
the and it is one of the most scandalous things of the way this war is being progressed at the moment, is the situation of Blackwater, who are unanswerable to anybody. They are unavailable to any of us here because they would tend to get lost.
And they go to Shannon Airport.
They're secretive, aggressive, and they're just unaccountable to anybody.
How early did you start reporting about Blackwater in Ireland? 2004?
We came across the first, I think, when those guys were killed in Fallujah who were members of Blackwater.
2004?
Yeah.
Okay, guys, we have to move because we're pressed for time, okay? Opposition to the Iraq war. Okay, I have a question. I have a quote here. RTE, March 15, 2008. The Irish anti-war movement claims the West liberation of Iraq is now a permanent and bloody military occupation. So, this question is for you, bro. What is this anti-war demoralization 5 years after the beginning of the war? It's a very recent book, last month. They're not claiming. These people are watching what's happening in Iraq. This is not the Bush administration. We live in a parallel world. These are facts.
I think the way to define facts is tricky when you're coming from... that story was probably written by one of our journalists. In the online section, it was probably either from a wire story or it was from a local RT journalist kind of putting it in the copy file. Either way, to make any kind of factual statement is a dangerous territory because without any attribution. So there's a general policy that we have to attribute most instances do that. Now, if it's five people are dead and there are five people laying on the ground and covered, that is a fact. You don't need to say police say five people are dead. But in any story, if you go through RTE, we're going to be attributing most things that may very well be facts, but we want to say where these facts are coming from in this particular instance.
I guess it's the verb that's at issue here, though, isn't it? It's the verb. The verb claims.
Claims.
You know, sort of exactly. Fairly elementary in journalism that when you say claims, you're casting doubt.
No.
Says is the neutral verb that you use in this situation.
Right, but it could very well be that a paragraph earlier they did use the word says, and they used the word claims for kind of, you know, mixing it up and whatever. But to assume, no, I mean, you don't say fire, 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 fire. You say fire, blaze. You know, it's bad journalistic writing.
But you do say says. Over. That's the one exception to that.
No, not at all.
The assumption that claims is to suggest that is actually not a fact is wrong. I don't think that our journalists use the word claims as a hidden way to say this is full of crap. I think they use the word claims to mix up the verbiage, and it is the reader's inference whether or not it is false.
But a lot of readers will interpret this as an accusation. You know that.
I would think that's their bias. That's the reader's bias, and I think as journalists. In the U.S. media, absolutely, they would report it as fact because they were hoodwinked by the Bush administration. They assumed that the U.S. government was an authoritative source, and they didn't. In many, many cases, they should have not made that assumption because in no way were they authoritative. But certainly, when we do it, and it's from a wired copy, we are going to be skeptical, or rather, we're going to cite the source that we got this piece of information from, and it's up to the reader whether or not they want to assess it, whether it's true or false.
Harry, I have a question. Do you think there's an overall attitude of mainstream media towards public opposition to war that's relatively negative?
Well, it depends on when and where you're talking about precisely. I don't want to make unwarranted generalizations. I mean, there certainly was a period before the launch of the war in March 2003. There was a period for really a couple of weeks there in mid-February when the media was definitely on site. And people here who were spokespeople for the anti-war movement and whatever know that they had access during that time. It's still the case that, you know, and a group of us research this, it's still the case that if you look at the main press in Ireland, In the period leading up to the war, articles about the anti-war movement, the sources are still 4-1 official sources as opposed to movement sources and civilian sources, as it were. The sourcing is still coming largely from officials who are taking mostly a negative attitude towards the movement. So, but I think it is the case that the movement was able to get some traction at that time. On the other hand, when you had, you know, possibly the most decisive action against the war in Ireland, the action of Mary Kelly, and the action of the Pitstop Plowshares in early February of 2003, the editorial in the Irish Times called the Pitstop Plowshares lawbreakers. Now, as it happens, they had been arrested and accused of a crime. They were eventually, in 2006, acquitted of crime. They were not lawbreakers. They were innocent people, innocent until proven guilty, and they were proven innocent. But on the day after their action, the newspaper, which is usually very cautious in these sorts of things, in its editorial said, the lawbreakers will be seen to, you know, the lawbreakers will have to face the full rigor of the law. So it's, and the particular form of action certainly was extremely negatively viewed. The tradition of nonviolent civil disobedience was never explored, understood, or even really reported on in the period in the run-up to the war. I think I can say that with a fair amount of certainty, even in the face of my colleagues who are present here.
Patrick,
I think once any conflict, the war started, the media, like everybody else, gets caught up in it and goes, gung-ho is probably the wrong word, follow the war, and everything else other than the pictures of tanks going across the desert or people speaking in that country tends to be forgotten about. And the anti-war movement then does become sidelined, and it's a question then of how relevant can an anti-war movement in a country like Ireland actually be?
Mm-hmm.
probably irrelevant unless you're talking about the small one specific issue of the Shannon stopover. You're talking in generalization.
That doesn't say that was a small issue when most American troops in Iraq came through Shannon.
Let me say a single issue rather than a small issue.
I think there was two phases in the anti-war movement, and it was reflected, and I think I was right to say that there was probably a shift in attitudes. The mass demonstration in Dublin of whatever the figure was, 100,000, was covered extensively, and editorially, I think. My own paper has supported it, and editorially my own paper has criticised the war, and it has suggested that it was illegal in terms of UN mandate. But I think that what happened in the later phase of the anti-war movement is there was a perception, rightly or wrongly, that the anti-war movement was now much less a mass movement and much more a movement of small number of activists, and the coverage probably reflected that minority, that perception of it as a minority force. And I think that probably did not do justice to the anti-war movement, but I think it's understandable. And I also think that there remained the possibility of getting access to my own paper, much more so than other papers, it has to be said. And I would accept the criticism that Harry makes about law breakers. I think that was a mistake.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but you have to keep going. Second topic, liberation or occupation. So we can examine a little bit of disconnect between the coverage of the Iraq War, getting rid of Saddam, and the occupation itself. March 24, 2004, Independent Institute for Administration and Civil Society Studies. They run a poll and they discovered that 92% of Iraqis saw the coalition as occupied. And in fact, any one of us who'd been to Iraq knew already 2004 the absolute majority of the population, Sunni or Shiites, excluding the Kurds, was against the occupation. Every recent poll said that, but then, okay, Irish Times, March 20, 2004. Attitudes towards the Americans, joyous in the first days of liberation, they were not joyous. The Shiites were extremely skeptical of American supporters. The Sunnis saw it was a catastrophe. And the Kurds were already liberated because they lived in a tolerable zone. Were soon tempered by the slow pace of rebuilding. There was no rebuilding to speak of. So, Patrick,
well,
why the mainstream media cannot call a cat a cat?
All I would say to you is that our correspondent in Iraq at the time...
This was written by one of your correspondents in Iraq.
Well, I don't know where it's come from.
Jack Fairweather.
Ah, yeah. Yes, he was one of the people that we covered... The military operation and its aftermath. We had a number of writers on the subject. I don't think we found a formulation like that from Lara Marlowe, who was there for that period too. So I think that that was probably a generalisation too far. That was not. But I don't think it was. It wouldn't have reflected the general coverage of that.
Dar, you want to step in?
Well, I
give us an insight view
from
Fallujah, the first siege made.
Well, again, I almost feel like an odd duck here because, you know, any criticisms of the Irish media, I would love, you know, what they're being criticized for, I would love to see that, you know, in mainstream media in the U.S. It would be a glorious time. Instead, we have the Judith Millers and, of course, her often co-author in the New York Times, Michael Gordon, who still writes for the Times.
And you, of course, well.
Sorry?
And
right, and still writes about Iraq, too. But really, it's a situation, I mean, the coverage has been so insane in the U.S. to this day. I mean, the other day we have a story I believe it was run in the New York Times, where they talked about Sauder. It was before he had just canceled the huge demonstrations he had called for today. And this, the lead was something like, Mukhtar al-Sadr's calls for demonstrations against the, in quotes, occupation. I mean, how is this not an occupation? But in the U.S., it's still referred to as that. And then the things like, kind of what was mentioned earlier about, you know, claim that the situation is a disaster. Well, we've got a country now whose population was 27 million people when the war was launched. It's now under 25. We don't know exactly how far under, but according to an Oxfam International report that came out last July, 4 million in need of emergency aid. According to UNHCR recent figures, minimum 4.9 million people displaced from their homes. And according to Just Foreign Policy, or ORB, depending on who you listen to, between 1.1 and 1.3 million dead. That means well over 30% of the total population of the country are either in need of emergency aid, displaced from their homes, or dead. How is that not a catastrophe? How is that not an absolute disaster? And yet, at least in the U.S. media, that's just not touched on. I mean, you would never see those figures together. Every once in a while, you'll see maybe a UN figure, but for the most part, it's just, you know, again, more of just kind of the state line of, well, we're going to focus on Petraeus, and now Petraeus is saying, well, things are getting better. In Fallujah, the April and November sieges were really just key examples of that, where being on the ground in Iraq, and especially being in Fallujah during the April siege, and then coming back out to Baghdad and reading how it was being reported back home, it was like two completely different situations. Are we talking about the same city here? Literally, where, you know, most people in Fallujah, especially during the April siege, were like, hey, we're just trying to kick the Americans out of it, keep them out of our city. That's it. You know, we're against them. There's no Abu Musab al-Barkali. There's no terrorists here. You know, these are people from Fallujah. I saw them with my own eyes going out and fighting the Americans, and yet you read the mainstream press, and it's well, you know, the terrorists and this, you know, the anti-American people of Fallujah, you know, the Saddam holdouts, the Saddam loyalists. I mean, again, no history, no context. Fallujah was not a very pro-Saddam city to begin with. But again, just this huge disparity in reporting.
Invisible Iraq is a bit. This is a thing that you know very well, all of us know, because usually they are not featured in any Reuters AP dispatch, and usually the correspondents ignore them completely. Because they are not reliable in terms of providing information. They are considered, I would say they are considered by Western media as untrustworthy. On the other hand, we have this unnamed U.S. official popping up in every Reuters or AP dispatch. Okay. RTE report. An unnamed U.S. official reported to have said that more than 600 insurgents have been killed in the battle for the Iraqi city of Fallujah. So this is the official line, right? Joe, so why Iraqis are not reliable? Because they don't speak English?
No. I think it would be the same as going to the streets of Texas and trying to get somebody's statement on the war there. Or it's a difference between authoritative sources and non-authoritative sources.
So, okay, but why a unnamed U.S. official who's spinning something, as we all know, is more reliable than an Iraqi eyewitness of a civilian bomb?
I don't think they are more reliable. I think by publishing something like that, we are trusting the Reuters journalist who presumably wrote that piece to make the decision on whether.
You know that Reuters dispatches are beaten in Baghdad. You know that.
I'd like to say something.
Yeah.
I actually think I try to get an eyewitness to a bombing, for example, in Baghdad, in any part of Iraq at the moment, is so difficult because for you to get from wherever you are, whether outside the Ring Zone, if you're staying in the Palestine Hotel, over to this place, it often is impossible to move. So you have to. And I myself, when I'm there, I don't ever try to report on a great political movement. This leader says this, this leader says that. I think in a conflict like this, all you can report on is what's in front of your face. And what you see yourself, people you talk to yourself, I've spoken to hundreds of Iraqi civilians in Fallujah before the invasions ever happened, dozens and dozens of people everywhere. But I think the difficulty then for people like me is that I can't find out what happened way over the other side of the city. I have to accept what either Reuters, PA,
AFP, whoever is in
today.
That is a critical. All I can say is it's been reported. This, I saw the plume of the smoke there, but it's not possible.
But that's a point for a smoke. You're entitled to doubt this report.
Of course I doubt them. And I think anything you hear in Iraq at the moment you take with a pinch of salt, you can believe almost nothing. And I do the 1.3 million dead. I find that figure difficult to believe as well.
Well, when you were in Iraq, and you knew how difficult it was to see the big picture, and you were painting really good small pictures, you, I think, came back from one of those trips in 2004 and said, actually, I've had to reconsider my previous opposition to the war because the civilian casualties have been much lower than I feared they would be before the war began.
And I would tell you why that was. Immediately after the war, to believe it or not, Baghdad went through an economic boom. The number of cars in the city increased by threefold. You drove in from Amman and you were overtaken by car transporters bringing second-hand cars from Europe in there. The big restaurants in the city closed down and turned themselves into white goods shops, so the pavements were lined with washing machines, dishwashers.
Yeah, that was benefiting from this. 1% of the population.
That's what they did with the vacuum building.
But that's, the place went through an economic boom. Everything had changed. There was an awful lot of suspicions about the Americans at the time. I actually didn't believe a lot of that initial opposition came from any political outlook. It was the bad behavior of the U.S. military on the ground. They just drove their tanks through motorway marshes and knocked everything down. Soldiers were very young, very badly trained. They were shouting at people at checkpoints, knocking people around, and that had a huge influence on it. I didn't think the initial opposition to them came from any nationalistic or political outlet. It was individual experience.
But even though you knew that you couldn't possibly know the big picture, you still thought that you knew enough to say the civilian casualties hadn't been so bad after all.
In the immediate aftermath, in comparison to what we had been told by the Iraqi officials before the war. As I said earlier, they were predicting this Stalingrad siege of Baghdad, which never happened. So in that context, it wasn't as bad. But this was immediately after, maybe 6 months after the initial invasion.
I think it was about on the first anniversary.
Yeah, and there was, every night in the hotel I was in, just in the middle of town, there was a gunfight on the street every night, every single night, and then the American tanks would come down and sort it out, and everybody would go back to bed. And it was an extraordinary place, but it obviously did have, it had quite a lot of traumas as well. It felt like a bit like a Wild West frontier because there was no taxation. Mobile phones had just been introduced.
That's why the
And then it just got progressively worse and worse and worse, and the U.S. forces, and Paul Bremer in particular, had to take 75% of the blame for that.
Why not 99?
Well, okay. No, because I think...
That would be destroyed in life.
Yeah, but there were militias there which grew up, were ready to capitalize on the situation.
150,000 extremely well armed and well trained men, I guess. Any government in place, and I guess the occupants.
And plus, he disbanded the police and army. In the most armed society in the world, everybody had a gun, and when they got dissatisfied.
Well, you were talking about the Palestine. I found this pearl. I don't know if it was in a PBS documentary called Frontline. I'm sure some of you are aware. And I found this quote by Thomas Rich, Pentagon correspondent for the Washington Post. We are holding the U.S. military to an extremely high standard, and I think it should be held to a high standard. I think most people in the military that I know would welcome that standard. On the other hand, a soldier inside a tank has a very limited view of the world. He literally can't see that much. So I always had a certain sympathy for the guys in the tank that shot up the Palestine Hotel and killed some journalists during the attack on Baghdad. What kind of journalist is that?
It's somebody who reports on the war from the bar of the Shelburne Hotel, I'd imagine.
I wanted to add a few points earlier, this is going backwards a little bit, but quoting a U.S. military official is saying that there's 600 dead insurgents in Fallujah. Well, it was that information, I mean, assuming that was reported while it was going on, there's no way, there's zero credibility to that whatsoever. And then afterwards, when doctors from Fallujah General Hospital told me personally, 736 dead, we estimate minimum 60% of them civilians, me and several other journalists I know, I wasn't the only one, lots of Arab journalists, plenty of Arab journalists walking up and down the bodies buried in the soccer stadium, looking at the headstones. I mean, you can do a rough estimate right there. Well, yeah, definitely over 60% of these are likely civilians because they're kids and they're old people and they're women. So again, why quote a military official on this type of stuff when we know that the U.S. military, I mean, part of their stated agenda in military documents is total, it's an information war, right? Rumsfeld said the war of ideas, control the information, win that war, no matter what. So you've got these basically flats out there putting out all this nonsense. So why trust them? Why quote them at all unless you're going to hold their quote up and then directly beneath or above it, let's put some official, Iraqi doctor quotes, et cetera, from hospitals that would have a lot better idea. And then regarding the economic boom, I mean, I too saw the Baghdad streets basically got undrivable because there were so many cars and the walls of sewing machines and washers and dryers and air conditioners lining the streets, in parts of Karada and et cetera. But again, this is all very clearly part of the Bremer plan, the Bremer orders. We're going no tariffs. It's a free-for-all. Everything can be imported into Iraq. Meanwhile, unemployment's going up through the roof. Inflation's going up through the roof. People were starting to already struggle to be able to afford items from the marketplace. They were starting to cut items from the monthly food ration. It was becoming harder and harder for the average Iraqi, not in a privileged position, not collaborating with the occupiers to actually get by and survive. And really, we look at Iraq's economy today, unemployment vacillates, according to the Iraqi government, between 40 and as high as 70% at times. Inflation, last I checked, was 7% in addition to that. And another 70% of Iraqis don't even have access to safe drinking water, according to Oxfam. I mean, that's the situation today. And then even early on, I think calling it an economic boom is quite misleading because, again, it was an elite at the top that were benefiting economically, mostly those who were collaborating with the Americans and not the average Iraqi. And then with the number dead, I actually feel confidence in those figures because they're based on the Lancet report. And to date, the Lancet study is really the only legitimate scientific survey we have to go on of Iraqi dead. And when the report came out in October of 2006, that was 655,000 was their mean that they estimated dead, 2.5% of the total population of the country. And that survey was done excluding areas of high fatalities like the Najafs and the Fallujahs intentionally because they knew it would be a controversial figure. They wanted to make it bulletproof. And so the more recent figures being based on that and extrapolating from, of course, when we have to add the fact that when the Lancet came out, I mean, this was before some of the most violent periods of the entire occupation, particularly around the Shrine of Al-Aqsa bombing in February 06, et cetera. So I think actually those numbers that we see today between 1.1 and 1.3 million are actually closer to accurate than anything. And certainly, if we talk about Iraq body count, I mean, this is a if you quote Iraq body count, I mean, this is a website where you can read on there and see for yourself that they admit that this is too low of a figure. John Sloboda on BBC admitted it's at least three times below what the figure may be, and I think he's still way off. But even he's admitting that. So just as a journalist to quote, for example, IBC, and I'm not saying RTE does this or any of the Irish media, but in the U.S., it's everywhere. Everyone quotes IBC. At best, as a journalist, if you're doing that, it's extremely sloppy journalism. I mean, that is not a credible source whatsoever. And at worst, it's being complicit.
Patrick? I agree that we shouldn't quote these figures uncritically, and I would be just as categorical about not quoting the 1.1 million uncritically, because I think I have to say that I think the Lancet methodology is something that makes me very nervous. Basically, for those who don't know what the Lancet did or the survey, it was an American university.
Before you go on, UK Minister of Defense chief scientific advisor was saying that the reserve was robust, close to best practice, and balanced. He recommended caution in publicly criticizing this. This was the UK Ministry of Defense.
I'm often skeptical of statements from the
Canadian. We are.
Just to explain the methodology, because it is, I'm not saying that the figures aren't ultimately right. I just don't know, and I would not want to see them quoted as fact any more than the Iraqi body can. Basically, small samples, survey areas were taken, and households were questioned about the number of dead that they in those particular households. Very limited areas, and then they've got a figure and they multiplied it by the whole of Iraq. As a methodology, in a country that is as dysfunctional as Iraq is, I'm just not sure that you can do that. I don't actually believe that is a valid survey method. And even then, the Lancet survey came up with a figure of 90% certainty of the casualty total being between 426,000 and 794,000. So even the Lancet is hedging very, very substantially. And then you move on and you extrapolate from that and you come up with 1.1 million. Let's not underestimate the number of casualties in Iraq, but let's also be careful about that methodology.
The IRS publishes opinion polls all the time that are based on sound methodology.
Opinion
margin of error.
Of course, but opinion polls where the surveys are carried out in societies that are relatively normal. And I think that there is a considerable difference between carrying a survey opinion poll in Dublin and carrying an opinion poll in Iraq. And I just made one other point, and it's about that demon which is the war services and the view that the war services can know that their perspective is cannot ever be trusted. I think we are in danger of generalizing. I think that over the last few years, particularly, I think there's been a significant improvement in the way in which the war service from Baghdad have reported from Baghdad. And I just quote today's report from Reuters, because I think it's illustrative of a change that takes on board some of the criticisms that have been made. It says at least a dozen people were killed in Baghdad's Shia slum of Sadr City on Wednesday, despite vehicle bans aimed at preventing unrest and spreading on the fifth anniversary of the fall of Baghdad. Police said six people died in clashes overnight and an explosion in the morning, whose cause was unclear, hit a funeral inside eastern Baghdad district that is home to 2 million, killing six more and wounding 14 people. Dr. Qasim Al-Mudawa told Reuters four bodies and 23 wounded had been brought to the Imam Ali Hospital. He manages the Sadr City, where US and Iraqi forces have battled militia loyalists from Qadr al-Sadr. What are they doing, he said. The floor of the hospital is covered with blood of children. What is the world doing? They have seen the blood of our children and are doing nothing. I'm not saying that all Reuters reports are like that, quoting civilians, but it is too much of a generalization to say that all you get from wire stories and all you get from that kind of reportage is the American official military position.
I want to just, I think the statements that you made, fair enough about not going with too much certainty into the really high-end figures of what's being quoted by ORB Group and Just Foreign Policy of Iraqi deaths, but I think I know that we don't have much time, but the kind of the brief synopsis you gave of the methodology of the Lancet was really not accurate. I mean, this is the most updated methodology used across the world in crisis situations, specifically designed to go into places where it's difficult to report. I mean, this is what was used in New Orleans after Katrina. It's used in other places where there's natural disasters or wars or famines, etc. And the figures they come up with in those situations is never disputed. It's only been disputed in Iraq because it's such a highly charged political situation and because, of course, the ridiculous amount of media attention a group like Iraq Body Count has received.
Can I just say that I was in New Orleans as well after the immediately after the hurricane, and the official reports, the initial media reports of what happened there were utterly and completely inaccurate. It's just shockingly inaccurate. Stuff coming from the police is all lies. So it's not just Iraq, it's elsewhere as well.
But I wonder what coming up with a real accurate figure will do. I mean, will it cause the Democrats in Congress to say, oh wait, it's 1.1 million, not 400,000, I'm going to cut off the purse strings. I really think that's taking the eye off the ball. And if people are focused on getting American and British troops out and ending this war, the way people need to go about it needs to change, I think, because
you
quibble over numbers, you're going to involve
in... The goal is that there was a military genocide in Iraq. This is the goal.
Yeah,
not what the Americans think about.
Right, but the problem...
The most important fact is there was a military, and there's a continuing military genocide in Iraq.
Can I summarize a couple of points?
Yes,
sure. Probably for a natural segue. First of all, in relation to, you know, you made a quote there, if you can fly the time to right now. In fairness to the Irish Times, a number of years ago, quite a detailed piece on Israeli incursion into Palestine, into the West Bank, and we talked specifically about the danger to civilians, men, women, and children, posed by the use of Israeli tanks and built up areas. That has often been repeated in analysis pieces for the Irish Times when it applied to Iraq. And in fairness to foreign papers, you referred earlier to the 2004 period, the uncapped of Fallujah. If you go back into the archive, you'll find that we had a number of articles in the Liverpool itself where the word Vietnam was used in the headline more than once. And in fairness to the Irish Times, the use of White Prosperous in Fallujah was called, the use of the words war crime were used by the newspaper. And again, in those articles, I highlighted the fact that men, women, and children are likely to be most, women, children, and the elderly are likely to be the victims. Because they're confined, they can't get out of places like Fallujah. So I don't think that during that 2002-2004 period that the Irish Times would be accused necessarily of being, you know, cheerleaders for the war effort. Just to go back to another couple of points that I think you were there. In relation to mercenaries in Blackwater, I think the Irish Times, at Paddy's behest actually last year, I did a piece on Blackwater, went to the US Military Depot, also went to the Geneva Conventions, and showed quite clearly that there are no sustained security contractors. They have mercenaries. And that was printed without any editorial interference whatsoever, which was called for what it was. And we also gave quite a forensic piece of analysis of the reaction of these mercenaries in a civilian environment that inevitably would lead to Iraqi civilian casualties. Just penultimately, mention was made of Shannon. I think the Irish Times was the only newspaper, I think of the only journalists who have gone to Shannon and interviewed American troops. And we did not step back from the numbers that have gone through or the fact that they were carrying weapons. And I provided audio to RT, which they broadcast, where it was said on the planes, you know, please leave your weapons on the aircraft, you're not bringing them to the terminal building. So the second thing underplay or try to de-emphasize the role of Shannon in the war in Iraq.
Sorry, can I just say
sorry, yes.
We're going to open it for questions.
We opened it.
We're going to open a discussion.
We opened it as a quote from Tom Cooney. I'm often mistaken for Tom Cooney. My name is Tom Stillman, and I'm often being confronted with dinner nights and etc. So you're for Tom Cooney. But at the same time that Tom Cooney wrote his piece, which you likened to a press release from you know, the Pentagon or Department of Defense, it was published in the Department of History of the Irish Times again on the day that the Bush Blair dossier on weapons of mass destruction was released. I had a piece in the Irish Times which was published, which quite clearly stated that this so-called dossier had no new information, it was not a military document, did not contain any military information, and was purely emotive in nature. So I think, in fact, still, and I would also like to add that in every instance there, RTÉ broadcast my comments and did in-depth interviews on that, and, you know, provided some balance in the coverage.
And
if I were to make one criticism of the media here in Ireland about the coverage of war, I would say that unlike other countries, we don't have a tradition of dedicated defence correspondence. Unfortunately, it is part of, it's an add-on to crime and security correspondence. I don't think that's good enough. I think we want to get a full understanding of what war is about, which is what I try to do as a veteran of three different conflicts, as a participant in war. You've got to understand the hardware, you've got to be able to call it and interpret it correctly. And so if I were to make one criticism of the way in which the media handled, you know, make use of defence correspondence and make use of the analysis. It does complement what foreign correspondence and development correspondence see on the ground.
I think the argument's been run. Like, we were charged with $2.5 million criminal damage to the American warplane at Shannon Airport. The Irish Times claimed that it was paid by the Irish taxpayer, which was a lie. It came out in the court. Mainstream media said we assaulted and hospitalised a member of the Garda Síochána Conor, who got up on three trials under oath and testified that we comforted him while he had a stress attack. yet we went to court and unmediated, a jury randomly chosen from a very disengaged society with this war, could not find us guilty of a crime. And after government, arranging all sorts of talent, once they heard from us and our motivation, once they heard from Jimmy Massey, who was part of the US Marines, once they heard from Kathy Kelly, who was under the bombing in Baghdad, they had no problem with the moral clarity and damaging part of the war machine as a response to the illegality, the immorality of this war. And what the mainstream media does is to marginalise anything beyond a gentleman's agreement that you can have your protest while we have our war. And if you go beyond marching in the streets, then you'll be marginalised, you'll be lied about, you'll be demonised, and, there's only 96% of jury trials in this city end in guilty, end in convictions. It's very rare that you ever have any unanimous acquittals. In this case, there was one. Yet that was marginalised, and that's, the argument has been won. This war has never had any popular support. It shows you they don't need popular support to have wars these days. The Democrats won the congressional elections 2 years ago and have done nothing. But once you move into nonviolent resistance, beyond that gentleman's agreement, then you'll face those kind of consequences.
Sorry, once again, we're pressed for time. We have to go to our last topic, which is basically that silly narrative of the war in Iraq now moving into a build-up for a possible attack on Iran. It's eerily similar. I think the techniques of manufacturing consent are exactly the same, and they are all derived from projects from the new American sector. Yeah? Well, I found this on Irish Times, May 1st, 2006. An editorial. Military action by the U.S. outside the United States auspices would be a dangerous spot for us. It would precipitate regional turmoil. Well, the regional turmoil is already there. Escalate anti-American terrorism. It's already there. Disrupt world oil supplies and therefore the international economies. And reinforce popular support for the Iranian radicals whose sources of power are uneven and precarious. Well, they are not uneven and precarious because they control everything in Iran. They control the military, the judiciary system, most of parliament, the press, the foundations, almost all of the economy. So there are some conceptual mistakes in this editorial. And the rest of the editorial is interesting because President Bush says he supports a political and diplomatic approach. He refuses to engage directly with Iran. That's correct. But what the editor doesn't say is that the Iranians themselves have proposed in 2003, via the Swiss ambassador in Tehran, sit down anywhere in a table with the Americans and discuss everything. This proposal was relayed by the Swiss ambassador directly to Washington and was flatly refused by the Bush administration. Then we have what Colonel Lawrence Wilkinson, former Chief of Staff for Colin Powell, he told the Washington Notes blog, which is a very influential blog, at least in Washington circles. I also outline for my audience all the time, some of them when we had maximum leverage, that we refused dialogue over the past 4 years. The default decision by the cabal, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Bush, after he had promised the statutory process, was achieved. No talks with evil people, particularly those occupying prominent positions on the axis. So, as journalists, we know that the Bush administration does not want a dialogue with Iran. They want regime change. And then they come with this smoke and mirrors new Iranian nuclear program, right? So, Patrick, why not point to all these discrepancies?
Well, I think you have. I think if you read a very fine opinion piece written by Lara Marlowe about 6 weeks ago, she would have made all the arguments that you're making.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you will find that there is not one but two or three editorials which have clearly opposed American any action against Iran. I mean, I think I mean, I've also reported the failure of the International Atomic Energy Agency to find any smoking gun, and that
But it has to be said, we also have to report the fact that the IAEA does support sanctions against Iran, and that Iran has refused to cooperate fully with the inspectors. And you have to report Ahmadinejad's extraordinarily bellicose statements about the destruction of the evil empire, or phrase that he
it's important that
some of this is context because
this is also taken out of
what
he said in October 2005.
I'm talking about yesterday when Ahmadinejad was talking about the fact that they've just installed 6,000 new centrifuges. He made a big speech saying that this was a magnificent demonstration of Iran. Ability to overcome.
He has to say that this is for internal consumption.
We have to report it. We have to say.
I know.
We have to say.
But this is not a declaration of war.
Yeah, he's for you. He's simply about the destruction of the imperialist. what was it? Chief. It was another word. But there was. In the context of speaking about centrifuges. So I'm not saying that. I don't believe that Iran is at the moment trying to create nuclear weapons. But I think you have to look at that context. I think it was looking at nuclear weapons, that it has clearly stopped doing so, and that the Iran also has the right, which we have reported under the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, which they are signatories to, but which they're not complying with in terms of inspections. They have the right to develop peaceful nuclear power, and we have reported all of that. And and we have also reported the fact, and I think this is very interesting in terms of the dynamics of Washington, the resignation of the general who was in charge of the region, who was opposed to military intervention. But in terms of the reports that we're getting from Washington, it does appear that there is no stomach in the American administration for an attack on Iran.
But American administration wants to say Cheney is circle runs foreign policy. It's a completely different story. They ran the Iraq war and they will run an attack, a possible attack on Iran.
I think it's politically extremely unlikely.
And I also think it's militarily impossible for them unless it's a one-off area strike. This time last year, I was sitting in a U.S. military base in just by Sadr City, about to interview this colonel who was in charge of the air. And I said, "Oh, I hear you're about to invade Iran." And just as I said, a mortar dropped in the yard outside, and everybody just laughed. It's a military impossibility. And I really think that when you look at the real politics situation, nobody takes it.
You know all those Pentagon plans. Hitting 10,000 strategic targets and collapsing the infrastructure of Iran. This is what they're
going to do. Like Aaron said, they're going to do it. They're going to do it. But I think this is actually an example of the media covering the story the way they maybe should have Iraq, which is really fleshing out all sides. And you see then the support dropping in Europe, especially
There's no support anywhere. You know.
There's some support in the presidential race that's been fleshed out, but in the U.S. presidential race, but it's not enough to justify the expense and the personnel and certainly the political capital they would lose. But of course, you know, Bush and his administration are lame ducks at this point. They've got 9 months left or something. So
that's why
if they want to do it, they're going to do it, and the media and nobody else can stop them.
I'd like to just interject context again. In these stories, and again, I don't know about Irish media, but in the U.S., not once have I ever seen in a big outlet reporting on this issue, why does the U.S. get to have 10,000 nuclear weapons and Iran can't have one? Why does Israel...
Why does Israel have more than 200?
Over 200, and Iran doesn't get one. I mean, that should be prominent in every story. I mean, why the double standard?
Yeah, why do India and Brazil, for instance, have civilian programs and Iran cannot have one?
I was in the United States at the end of Daddy Bush's reign. I was just released from prison after disarming a B-52 bomber, and just before I got the more traditional punishment of transportation to Australia. there was a totally unnecessary drive-by cruise missile attack by Daddy Bush just on the cusp of Clinton coming in. I think it's a mistake to see these wars as very sectioned off. The war in Iraq has been going on since the first Gulf War, through the sanctions, through the escalation, and now occupation. The war in Iran, similarly so, there's been, the US Navy has been permanently deployed in the Persian Gulf for decades. I mean, could you imagine a foreign navy being like that next to the coast of California? And it's a threat of war or war to get what they want. Violence and the threat of violence sustains exploitation, and that's what they want to do. They want to exploit resources of that region. And whether it was propping up the Shah for decades, or whether it's you know, being deployed there and shooting down an Iranian civilian plane in the 80s, or whether it's threatening them with the possibility of a nuclear strike, it's used in the same way. And I don't think they've got the stomach for an occupation, but I certainly think they've got, you know, whatever warp motives they have for a drive-by very similar to what Daddy Bush did at the end of his administration.
Now we're open to you. Your question. And our internet. Could you please come to the microphone? Thank you.
Hi there, David Manning, Media Bank. I'd just like all of you, like, thank you for coming, especially Patrick and Tom over there. One of the things we've encountered over the last year and a half is an unwillingness for the media to discuss criticism the way we're making, and especially the Irish Times. It was good to see two Irish Times journalists here tonight. But one of the things you were saying earlier about Mara Marlowe's journalism, and I agree, Mara Marlowe is one of the best journalists in Ireland at the moment, but we did analysis there of 2 months of Irish Times coverage on Iran. Now, the message throughout those stories, with only two exceptions, the first exception being Lara Marlowe, and the second exception being comments from the Russian government. With those two exceptions, the story being relayed by the Irish Times was Iran was a threat, Iran was meddling in Iraq, it was the resistance. Basically, that's what they were saying, even though there's no evidence to support that. That's what I'm asking.
Absolutely untrue.
Well, no. This is last year. Now there has the U.S. government has promised their evidence over the last year.
It's all through the streets know that Maktab al-Sadr, that the his people are completely maintained by Iran.
The point was made actually on RT not so long ago. Joe organised or webcast a speech by Seymour Hersh. Now Seymour Hersh outright said, Iran has, you know, it has its finger in Iran, but how could it not, you know, their neighbors. So the point was, whenever the US government claimed an IED attack was, you know, basically organized by Iran, the Irish Times, the Irish media in general, relayed that message completely uncritically, without any evidence. And I'm asking, why is that? Why can you not counter those things?
Okay, from my own experience, they've never said to me that they're organized in Iran, but that they say these devices are built in Iran. And they will show you them. The results are heavy engineering. It's not just a wire.
But you can buy them in the black market. You know that.
Yeah, but they're only for
selling. From the Republican guards in Tehran directly.
There's Russian weapons. I mean,
Russian
rocket launchers with resistance fighters in Baghdad. I mean, so what does that mean?
Exactly.
But it goes back to the discussion. is the discussion wasn't necessarily is he evil or not? I think everybody was on board that he's evil. The question was he evil enough to invade a sovereign nation, and is Iran a big enough of a threat to invade by air force or ground forces? That's really the debate that hasn't been completely fleshed out in the media, but I think by the fact that they haven't invaded, the U.S. hasn't invaded yet, means that enough people are not yet convinced that Iran is enough of a threat. And so it's not black and white, and it wasn't for Saddam either. I think it's making the decision of how what's the value of that threat.
It's extraordinary terms of the debate, though, isn't it, that the debate is about Iran as a threat. Exactly. When the United States has hundreds of thousands of troops occupying a Middle Eastern country, mm-hmm. you know, right. when it has the, you know, the record of what's done there from the last 5 years, mm-hmm. then we're weighing up whether Iran is enough of a threat for us or somebody like us, somebody with our color skin, to go in and have a go at this other
sovereign state hasn't done such a good job of it.
We're all afraid that the Bush administration are crazy, and I do believe, because that's a very good job.
Well, I don't read that in the Irish Times, but they were afraid that
we're all afraid that, you know, that the Bush administration will fire, you know, stay in the drawing board, and I think that they will not share the tax. So I have that on very good, from a very, very good source. But, you know, description doesn't mean advocacy. You know, if I write in great detail about some military innovation or whatever, it doesn't mean I'm supporting it. In fact, by describing it in such graphic and forensic detail, I'm hoping that people will understand the horror of what we condone collectively, either by omission or commission. But just in relation to Iran as a threat, I think it was last week in the Irish Times ran an article that I did on the proposed US missile shield to be deployed in Europe and in the Czech Republic and with missile silos in Poland. And in that article, I quite clearly state that when you look at the configuration and the footprint of their ballistic missile shield, it does not suggest that Iran is the American threat. It suggests that the threat that the Americans have identified are major emerging nuclear powers in Asia. And that's stated explicitly in the newspaper. I think it's very easy. You know, we're all unhappy with the state of affairs internationally. It's very easy, I think, to criticise journalists on the front line, people like Berger, and people like me who are, you know, trying to write for a 6 o'clock deadline what's going to make sense of the as well in a very, very fast-moving situation. But I would say, you know, in my experience, both as a participant in conflict and now as a person who stands back and writes about it, all of the journalists that I've met, you know, they do make an effort.
Absolutely. We're actually talking here about the structural and institutional limitations on the journalism. We're not talking about individuals. I mean, these are, you know, I mean, Fulham is a really good colleague and a really conscientious journalist.
Structures, apart from a radical transformation of societal structures. I mean, apart from making some journalism educational, you know, we can only do this incrementally. And I do think it is good that, you know, we have people from Washington and from the established or traditional press to at least answer it and debate it.
Well, I think having the discussion at least is a departure. I mean, not making any claims for us, but the fact that so many journalists are willing to come here to actually have the discussion is good. But there is one thing that I'm really questioning about, you know, some of the stuff you've been saying, Paddy, and you too, Tom, which is it's almost in terms of the actual language, the frame of reference in which you refer to what's going on. This is something that's very insidious. Almost like subliminal conditioning that's going on with people. Threat, always associated with Iran, never with the US. And yet, who is doing all of the killing?
I just to respond to David's point very quickly, I think that the paper has the right and should report claims made by the Americans that the Iranians are responsible. We've also published Iranian denials. So,
well, if this was, let's say, if it was Hugo Chavez of Venezuela discussing the threat that he feels he may be being subjected to by, say, a neighbouring country or another country somewhere in South America, and if he talked from the same position of power, of military power and might, about the possibility of invading another country that didn't even have one of those weapons, can you imagine how your paper and the news in the West generally would be writing about that? Because they're already half mad about Hugo Chavez, who isn't doing a fraction globally of what the Bush administration is doing. So it's the
turn. And as well as I have six different agencies tracking possible plots to assassinate Chavez or an invasion by special forces via Colombia. Nobody really talks about that.
Because there's not a whole lot of Western journalists in Venezuela. I mean, when I was working in Los Angeles, in the coup.
One or two, and they do the Miami line.
Yeah, it was right. It was a Friday night when the coup happened. We were all getting ready to go home for the weekend.
We were very
excited. Well, I was in Los Angeles, and I was working on Marketplace, which is a business program. And the only Western journalist that we were getting information from, I believe, was a Reuters journalist. And otherwise, it was all coming out of Washington. And, of course, the line out of Washington is, this is welcomed by the people and whatever. And over the weekend, we heard from one of our former journalists who's in Mexico City, and she said, look, everybody in the U.S. media got the story wrong. And, of course, as we saw on the record.
You just need to contact a Venezuelan journalist or even Colombians or Argentinians. They'll tell you rather.
Again, it's the systematic structure by which the American, and the Bush administration and their 30-year media project has counted on this, is that All of the corporate media made their job cuts in the 80s and the 90s. Foreign bureaus are reduced to nothing. I mean, what is it? The LA Times is the only daily newspaper in the U.S. that has a bureau in Iraq on a full-time basis. And so the reach around the world has been reduced in leaps and bounds, especially in American media, because of the corporate cuts, the need to satisfy your shareholder, and they were counting on this. I mean, don't think the broadcasting bill in the mid-90s didn't have that in mind. And that's the real problem with getting those kind of stories.
Yes. It would be nice to believe that the Irish Times was so influential that it would have a big bearing on what decisions are made in Washington or can be done. But I do believe the Irish Times has a big influence on what happens in Ireland, what happens in Leinster House, and what happens in our government. And it would be nice to think that maybe they would run an article tomorrow or the day after about the hypocrisy of the Irish government. Yesterday we had Mr. Dermot Kern, the day before yesterday was yesterday, standing up in Doyle Éireann, calling for the cessation of investment in cluster munitions, and he's taking a very strong line on that. Now, that is very commendable. He has fine words from our Minister of Foreign Affairs, and it would be credible if it weren't the fact that our government is utterly and totally complicit in what's going on and the deaths in the Middle East at the moment by allowing our airport at Shannon to be used for a war which was preempted, which was illegal and immoral. And I think that our government must be criticized and criticized far more by the established media in this country. And I would like to see something done about this tomorrow or the day after, please.
We've got an online question for the panel. Weren't the media guilty of not checking facts, especially if they came from the likes of Colin Powell?
But how do you check Yellowcake in Niger? I mean, nobody has a reporter in Niger, and that's the problem. I mean, going back to that one RT story you quoted, if we didn't quote the unnamed source, there's no story, and then we don't do an Iraq story that day. When 125 people died in a bombing, it was lead on the 6-1 news, but in our stats, it was the 20th highest ranked story on the page that day. There's a difficulty with putting Iraq stories out there that kind of desensitizes people, and so they're not shocking anymore. And thus, what is the value of reporting?
Can I just say, on the Colin Powell issue, I remember the day he addressed the UN Security Council. I was back in Dublin having just come back. And we had some discussion about, a few of us who knew a bit about the situation said, he's telling lies. So we had a discussion and we said, I would say, he's telling lies. We said he was telling lies on the day. And what more can we do with that particular day? Our problem is that we are a relatively small country. We're not going to have any influence on Colin Powell.
I think there are 2 points there. One is that Ireland underestimates its cultural currency in the diaspora in the United States, in Australia, in Britain, and also the diaspora in those militaries. If Ireland had spoken morally in the company of France and Germany against this war, it would have had huge ramifications. But you have, Ahern up there snivelling away under Haas's rage after her action, etc. And the mistake the anti-war movement makes is to think media is some kind of objective social service. It's a profit-driven industry, and it's state-sanctioned, and those reporters who act up end up on this end of the panel. You know, they get quite tilting on stuff. So it was quite interesting in our trial. The prosecutor kept hammering us, you did this as a publicity stunt. And we're like, we're not that deluded to think we'd get fair treatment in the mainstream media. We did this to stop this plane contributing to killing innocent men, women, and children, and the jury accepted that, and that's why we're British.
I'd just like to make a point and maybe have a bit of a discussion on it. The idea that journalists stuck in the green zone in Ireland, there's a truth or a ring to it that people can leave the green zone and verify stories and articles. I would suggest that there is no such impediment to investigating stories in Ireland. Lately, on the world stage, extraordinary rendition has become a very big noise. And only last week it was said by Dick Marty that to accept assurances from the American government was to be complicit in torture. I think there have been maybe, since the start of the war, there have been less than 20 visits by the mainstream media, the larger groups, to Shannon. There is no exploration of the legality of what is happening there. At the end of the day, all our governments throughout the planet, except the Americans, accept that rendition is an illegal act. There's no exploration of this in the media, for instance. It's always, nobody has actually been found to be rendered for Shannon. There's nobody, as I've ever said, in the anti-war movements with any credibility that there has. We're saying we're facilitating it. We're saying it's accepted that it's a crime. Why are we not using planes landing in Shannon as evidence, as opposed to diverting the attention each and every time by saying nobody has actually been found in Shannon? That's my point.
I just want to add another thing, and I'll be the context guy in this, in this discussion, where again, and it relates to a few of the other comments, where similar to the double-edged standard of reporting about Iran. Iran can't have one nuclear weapon. We'll just ignore the fact of the 10,000 and then the 200 and something over here in Israel. But the facts are on the table. I think as journalists, what is a more credible source? I mean, is there anything coming out of the Bush administration that should be treated as credible, or at least without quite, searing context? I mean, another document I wanted to read a quote from. It's a military document called Joint Vision 2020, and it states very clearly the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the U.S. military, his vision is, and this impacts U.S. foreign policy, dedicated individuals and innovative organizations transforming the joint force of the 21st century to achieve full-spectrum dominance. Yeah. That means total control of air, land, sea, information, and space. So this is the country with this type of agenda. Again, read the National Security Strategy, the Quad Offensive Report. Read these documents. It's very clear the U.S. agenda is basically to use the military to control the world's resources and use leverage in that way. What is the real threat to the world? What is the real threat to world peace? Is it Iran getting nuclear energy or one nuclear weapon? Or is it the U.S. that really, if you just read the documents, they're stated documents, this is the rogue state. And so why should that not be the context of this kind of reporting?
Absolutely. Can I come back to the extraordinary rendition question? It's my belief that news and media in general operates on, or in the small picture, individual people make news and make headlines. If we talk about big concepts like extraordinary rendition and 200 aircraft went through and came out the other side, it doesn't have the same grip on the public imagination. If we could find one person who was rendered through Shannon and get them to say, I've ended up in this place in Guantanamo, wherever I came through Shannon, it would blow the whole thing wide open. We're talking about 200-300 flights going through. What you want is the one individual.
I accept that. But at the same time, whilst you're waiting for that to happen, why not go out and report what is happening?
What is happening?
Well, what's happening, for instance, you're getting peace activists down there who do this story apparent to begin with, while the mainstream media basically vilified them. And they're making complaints to Gardaí. They're the ones being arrested. You don't see this in the media.
I mean, if you're blindfolded and chained butt naked to the floor of an airplane, how would you know you're in Shannon? You know? The data hasn't found any because they haven't bothered to look.
No, they haven't bothered to look.
Yeah.
No. And so how do we find one?
We know the planes that have been involved in the rendition today, whether they're on their way to commit a crime or on their way back, is inconsistent.
They're evidence. You know? Those planes are evidence. And we're still treating what you're looking for, they're looking for the smoking gun as being the crime. The crime, we already know what's happened. You don't need a smoking gun here. The point is, those planes are evidence. The guard should see them.
We've reported those planes.
I understand that, but have you called them evidence? Have you said, we asked the guard, have you checked this? How far have you explored these issues?
My point is, okay. I would suggest that you haven't explored.
We all have to explore in a country that is so secretive.
Trying to get the most basic information and something like that is next to impossible.
What is that story within itself? Yeah.
So, I mean, we need to try and get it on to the
example. I'd just like to ask both questions and third question from another angle. Because you seem to pretend that you're speaking objectively, close to an RTE and the Irish Times, and I think there's been a lot of examples that you're questioning. I'd like to put the question rather differently. Do you not accept that you are very constrained in what you can do at three levels? First of all, by the Irish government, which doesn't want the question of the war raised because of its relationship with America, because of its investment, US investment. As a state radio and as a leading newspaper, surely you must be aware of the constraints of that. Secondly, that actually as individual journalists, I'm sorry, it isn't all description, it is an opinion. Individual journalists have opinions, obviously they do. And so why could you not say, exactly where you stand on the war? Are you in favour of it? Are you against it? Do you believe that that would take away your credibility as a writer? Because in fact, there have been, as people are aware, plenty of journalists who have made that decision. And so therefore, I think rather, it's not that which I'm trying to have a go at you, I'm saying that do you not recognise that you're operating in a framework which is influenced by government policy, by editorial policy, for God's sake, in the Irish Times, a PD editor, surely isn't that, indifferent on these issues, and that therefore, surely one could get to a much deeper level of discussion to actually say, could you not say that you're against the war? After all, the majority of people in this country are against the war. Why is your commitment not to that democracy rather than to a very narrow idea of democracy that we're pushed for the very beginning?
Far be it for me to. No, we're not constrained by the government, frankly. It makes not one jot of difference what the government's view on this matter is. We function in a largely free media environment. Now, you may say that corporate pressures come on us. The Irish Times, as such, is not faced similar corporate pressures. It's owned by a trust. It does have an editorial policy, and the editorial policy has been to oppose the war. It has been to support direct action, but it has been to say that the war has been a disaster and that it was not legitimate
but
at
not
the time.
The
sorry?
But not to cover what the anti-war.
I'm sorry, you have got coverage, but you haven't got as much as you'd like. And the other thing is I think you've got to understand the nature of journalism. In the tradition that we work in, journalists are not supposed to be activists for or against war. They're supposed to report what's going on. And therefore, it isn't up to me, when I'm editing the foreign pages, to think, can I get my point of view across? I have to try and... this is very imperfect. And I wouldn't pretend that we get it right all the time. But my obligation, in terms of the obligations on me from the Irish Times Trust Constitution, is to separate fact from opinion, is to try and provide on foreign pages an assessment of what is going on and to remove my own opinions from it.
Can I ask the question about governments? Governments discussing this war, they're constraining discussion on the war in this country by the lack of information they're giving out about Shannon and what's going on in Shannon. So that is government restraint. As for editorial policy, I actually don't believe RTE has any editorial policy. In anything I've ever done, I've never been told you must cover it like this or like this. If I'm out reporting on something, no matter where it is, I don't think it's my place to express my opinion. I think that I should just reflect what I come across, reflect people honestly what I find on the ground. If I had my own personal opinion, I think if I started giving it in the story, people would just laugh at me and they'd be right. And as for the current situation in Iraq, if you ask for my personal opinion, I now don't see any alternative to the way the Americans are there at the moment, because if they leave, it will be even worse. And I think when the Americans and the British invaded the country in the first day, they took responsibility for it, and now they have to live up to their responsibilities.
That's not opinion itself. It's not opinion itself.
It is an opinion, yeah, but I mean, if I'm out reporting on a story, I'm not going to give my opinion because it's irrelevant.
She just asked four journalists to state their opinion. He stated an opinion that was not the opinion you wanted to hear. Now, any subsequent reports you think are going to be shaded by that opinion. My opinion from his about the war is very different. But I'm not going to say that because the people who support the war or the people who are pro-American, which we hear from, believe it or not, there are people in this country who still support the U.S. and their efforts, they're going to think that anything I report is going to be shaded. So this is the slippery slope of journalism right now in modern times, is that with 24-hour channels, you have constant opinion because that's the cheapest free way to fill the airways, and occasionally you have great down-the-middle journalism, and the problem is that people are so used to these noise-canceling machines from either side that when there's straight down-the-middle journalism, it's of no value to them, and it doesn't seem to change anything because the war still happened and countries still get invaded.
And I think as well in most things we do that people, all you should do is just report people's opinions, what's happening, and then the audience, the readers, the listeners are intelligent enough to make up their own minds.
Why is there so little coverage of what Diego got to say? It was horrendous what was done.
Yeah, Garcia was an example of total ethnic cleansing. Everyone got picked up and dumped in Mauritius. It's a B-52 bomber base. They bombed Iraq directly from there. It's British territory that's been subcontracted out to the United States. And they've rendered people through there, much to the embarrassment of the Brown Blair government. Why is there acknowledgement of the U.S. empire? Why is there acknowledgement the U.S. supported the Contras in Nicaragua? How can they be in any position to complain about Iranian support in Iran?
Hitler also he had no time for the apology, neither had Didier to apologize. Neither of them were quoted at all by any Irish journalist. Everybody was saying how this apology may never be right, and Hitler and Paul had no time for the consolidating the labels, and they wanted to see action, not words.
I'd like to thank the start of the discussion. I think the coverage of the build-ups of the war was actually quite used up, loaded time balance, and I think it gave the anti-war case reasonably well, and that partly contributed along with the activism to the wonderful demonstration we had on February 15th in Dublin. But that demonstration scared the living daylights out of the political establishment and I think the media. And that's one of the reasons that the coverage changed since the start of the war. I think as an anti-war activist, it's very hard to not believe, you know, that there is a bias against, maybe not totally pro-war, but certainly not reporting the anti-war movement coverage. And I'll give you three concrete examples. Two years ago, we called a press conference with a Green Party TD, Sinn Féin TD, Labour Party TD, Senator David Norris in the third anniversary of the war. Not one journalist came to that. At the same time, we brought out a statement which was signed by 100 prominent people in Ireland. We sent it to all the media establishments. Not one of them covered it. In the lead-up to the general election this year, PANA, an organization we work very closely with, I'm the Irish anti-war movement, we've worked very closely with the Peace and Neutrality Alliance, PANA, and they carried out a poll of 1,000 people across Ireland, an official MRBI poll, asking them one simple question: do they support the use of Shannon Airport by the US military? 68% of people said no. They then called a press conference to announce this, the results of this poll. Not one of the, no one from any of the media came. There might be Higgins there to report on it as the Labour Party foreign affairs correspondent. At the same time, we brought over Cindy Sheehan, who's a well-known peace activist, mother of Casey Sheehan, who was killed in Iraq. We, along with Rua Lamet, one of the 15 who was in Panama Bay, the day before general election which is a quiet day for the media. We flew to Dancy Shannon. You would think the media would be on orders, but there was a personal story there as much as the political one, because the last time Cindy Sheehan heard from her son Casey was a postcard from Shannon Airport. Not one of the media there took the Limerick Leader and two freelance journalists, so two freelance photographers. So it's very difficult for us who are involved in the anti-war movement to believe that the majority of Irish people are against the support by the Irish government for this war through the use of Shannon. It's very hard for us to see that the media is balanced. One last point, if you don't mind, on the question of Palestine. The horrible situation in Gaza, which 128 people were killed in 2 days, three Israelis got killed. Recently one of the reports, one issue which came up, the Defense Minister of Israel called for a Shoah against the Palestinian people. In other words, a Holocaust. It was reported I saw people at the time, but it's been very quickly dropped. Has the so-called call that the Iranian president made for the so-called wiping out of Israel, which is totally has that been dropped in the same way that this call by a deputy defense minister of the Israeli government be called for a Holocaust against the Palestinian people? And I would ask the people from the mainstream media here, why weren't you at all those events that I've cited? And will you please report the demonstration that's occurring this Saturday in commemoration of the Palestinian Nakba? Please be there for that.
There's a massive passive anti-war opinion in this country, in Australia, in Britain. There isn't a massive movement of activists. There's a remnant of activists. And the problem with the movement here is that it got cold feet when it should have moved from protest to non-violent resistance. And it, like the mainstream media, marginalised anyone who moved into non-violent resistance. It didn't offer them a platform at rallies, it didn't offer them solidarity while they're in jail. We weren't mentioned at all at February the 15th. And so it sowed its own defeat in that kind of politics. It lost its constituency, and unfortunately, the war goes on. It escalates and expands, yet there is no popular support for the war, but no visible popular opposition to it.
It's the same as in the US, actually.
Sorry?
Same as in the US.
Yeah.
Can I just respond to a couple of things?
And you look at, and obviously the great case in point is the Green Party that rode that wave into government and sold that movement out. And
Can I just respond to a couple of those things? The Cindy Sheehan thing I remember specifically. We put in a request to do a live web chat similar to what we're doing today with Cindy Sheehan, and we were told her schedule was too tight, and so we could have given her a huge audience on the largest media website in Ireland, and that was turned out. My guess is why the media didn't turn out to Shannon is because of that point in time, is because that one day before the election is when journalists were able to catch up on their sleeves after a month on the campaign trail. And the resources, but I'm not defending that, but the timing of that could have been poor, and it's not a complicit saying, oh, Cindy Sheehan's coming to Limerick, let's not cover her. But really, the core of why some things are covered and why some things aren't is, what's the news story there? If you go out in the streets, and when I used to consult for the Green Party in the U.S., as a communications consultant, I told them, you cannot come out to press conferences and say the same thing over and over again. The media will not cover you every single time. You need a fresh angle, and to be honest, if you take a hatchet to a U.S. warplane, that's going to get covered. If you're going out to the streets or you're holding a press conference with TVs who have no political influence in the Doyle, unfortunately, because they're on the opposition side, that's not necessarily going to get covered. I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying that's probably why all of those different things were not covered.
Just know that the Green Party case was finally appointed to government. You weren't advising the Green Party.
No, I wasn't.
Joe, you know, the Pitstop Fauchard's trial was very poorly covered in the media. So guys did take cameras to trans and women as well, and it wasn't treated as a big story.
Well, I wasn't here for most of that, so I don't know the layout, but I imagine it's probably the trial itself, as many trials do, probably lost their luster because there's no cameras in the courtroom, and it's hard, at least from the TV side or radio side, to cover trials.
All right, and I suspect the reason people didn't go to Shannon was because it was Shannon.
and it's the day before you had actually people getting in, in place, everybody's doing a lot of organization. Mm-hmm. If you had headed those in Dublin, you would have had coverage,
yeah,
I suspect.
Yeah.
And that's your question. Jill there just mentioned Palestine. I thought it was a bit ironic that the very first person Pepe quoted was Tom Cooney, correctly identified by Patty Smith as essentially an agent of the Israeli government in Ireland, even though when one read his many contributions to the Irish Times, it's never made very clear, and he is identified as a law lecturer in the field of medical law, which is a subject not even international law. However, this talks about this discussion about reporting war, and I believe even though Paddy and his colleagues there might be seeming to be getting a fairly hard time, they'd be getting a much harder time if the subject under discussion was Palestine and not Iraq, or as well as Iraq, shall I say, because I don't think that in relation to the coverage of Palestine, RTE has a leg to stand on. Maybe the Irish Times has a toe to stand on, but not certainly on a full leg. And both organisations, I feel, could be asked questions about the use of Israeli known Zionist figures and reporters. One of whom, not with the Irish Times anymore, David Harvis, went on to become the editor of the Jerusalem Post, one of the most right-wing Zionist newspapers in the world. And I remember, before we realised that it was a complete waste of time, the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, which I used to be chairperson, was constantly at the Irish Times, why do you have these people, why do you have the British, why don't you maybe have occasionally a Palestinian? In the case of RTE, there's a man called Mark Weiss, I don't even know if he still reports, a man who I believe lives in an Israeli settlement, an illegal settlement. And this man was, I don't know if he still is, reporting regularly, on the occupied territory, on the Gaza Strip, from his illegal settlement in Jerusalem. The second and final point, very briefly, we're talking here about the mainstream media a lot, and Paddy has made a distinction right at the beginning between the mainstream media, which provides some context, and the populist media, perhaps you want to say better media, I don't know, which don't. And I think it's a great pity. That puts a finger on a big problem in this country. But that's the only opposition we have. With respect to Harry, I don't think that Village magazine has really provided an alternative print outlet for people who do not share the neoliberal corporate consensus that prevails in this country. So one thing we need is a new media outlet, print outlet, because I don't think print media are dead at all, to which people could contribute as an alternative to the kind of fare we read in the Irish Times, independent newspapers, which nobody has mentioned yet, and of course RTE, which is fairly
Palestine. Sorry, real quick on Palestine. I agree that we would have a tougher time defending that because we would have half of this room filled with people from the Israeli embassy criticizing our coverage from that angle and people pro-Palestine. I got a letter from the ambassador of Israel a few weeks ago criticizing our coverage. So as a journalist, my rule is if I'm getting hit by both sides, that means we're probably covering the story as fairly as
possible. But
I'd like to ask the panel, in light of the framing of the debate, say, reporting war, what one unique change each of you would like to see in journalistic reportage working towards higher, better, a higher quality standard? What one unique change would you like to see?
I think personally, being realistic about it, in Iraq, is relying far more heavily on Iraqi journalists and having their literally letting them write the stories, not that for, and again, I'm this is a critique of U.S. media, not Irish, but like the New York Times, you read any New York Times story, and most of them out of Baghdad is going to have basically the white guy's name up here, and then one to three Iraqi names at the bottom of the story. And I know this because I've worked with interpreters that were some of those names.
We all know that,
and then
these people who never.
Those are the journalists, and they're not being credited. They bring back the information that's then heavily turned around and biased, usually in a pro-U.S. state fashion, and then written by that white guy. And then they basically are just, you know, these names at the bottom of the story. And the reality is those are the only people, with very, very, very few exceptions today, going out and getting that information. So why are they not given basically the free rein to do that and report the story exactly as it's happening, not bringing it back to go through the white filter, the white U.S. biased filter, before it hits the print? And I think that could be done right now as we speak by virtually any media outlet operating on the ground in Iraq, if you need stories that are, you know, the sources are outside of the green zone, and that's something that could happen right now. I mean, we're doing that at Interpress Service right now as we speak, but of course, compared to audience-wise, with larger media in the world, we're still talking about a very small audience.
Yeah, I would like to see more people out on the ground reporting things everywhere, and not just in Iraq, but in the Middle East. I think it is a scandal that RT doesn't have a full-time person in the Middle East. Also, it's incredible that there's nobody from the Independent News and Irish Independent here today, biggest media organization.
You're very
quiet. Yeah, well, that they didn't turn up, then, should I say, because there are people who send, they make millions of profits and send nobody anywhere. During the whole war, not one person left Midlaby Street to report on the war. Their best coverage of it came from the bar of the Shelburne Hotel. And I was like this, but nobody from Ireland, they take reports from the Independent News in London. That's how they do it. I'd like to see more people out on the ground reporting, because now with the technology we have, it's so easy to go anywhere.
I think it was Joe Jackson who said before they shot him, freedom of the press is for those who own one. And it's interesting, in Irish Independence attack on Damien Moran, who was detained by Homeland Security and deported last week, although he had no criminal record. I would like to see resuscitation of indymedia.ie, and I'd like to see Sokov speaking and Temple Bar and other places. But don't hate the media, become the media. Mm-hmm.
Last question.
I don't think I told you about this, but it's not a question, it's a statement. 30 years ago, the Irish Times was about the coming act of social change in Ireland. But now, no disrespect to its woman editor, I think it is a paper totally without balls.
Well, that's the voice of the people. Thanks very much for everyone. Thanks for our online viewers. I hope you are ahead of most of the world, I would say. A debate like this wouldn't happen in many other countries, even in Western Europe. You know, maybe in South America nowadays, where things are really happening. So I hope this is the beginning of a long friendship and many other debates, right?
Yeah.
That's what Media Byte is driving for.
I really respect everybody's comment and opinion, but it's of no value if this doesn't continue. We all know what's kind of going on. Without the debate like this, the movement, it doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't happen. It's 10 years on the debate. So if the organizers can take on board the people here and build it,
Thank you very much.